Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice. Our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh, yes. Well, welcome, everybody. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. First of all, let me thank you all for your patience. I do appreciate some of the emails that I had gotten making sure that everything was okay. I'm really sorry that I haven't gotten a podcast out for a few weeks. You know, I probably should have planned for this a little bit better, but just so many obligations that I had, particularly with my practice and some good things in terms of speaking that I've been doing around the country, and it has taken me away a little bit. And unfortunately, I didn't plan ahead, as I said, and I probably should have recorded a few of these podcasts ahead of time. But we are going to get back in to the swing of things. You know, I've had quite a few requests since I've started my podcast because I have alluded to the fact that my particular area of interest is in existential psychotherapy. And whether it's through the podcast or on the website, the emails, people want to know what this is. What is existential psychotherapy, and how does that explain our behavior? Well, here's what we're going to do. So part of what I do is teaching, in addition to my clinical responsibilities, and I do some teaching over at Ohio State University. I give some classes to the first and second year medical students, and also to the residents in psychiatry, those doctors that are training to become psychiatrists. Well, this year provided an opportunity for me to do a course there. And I hadn't done a course, had done occasional lectures there, but not a full class. And it's several weeks. And the focus of it is on existential psychotherapy. So I'm in the midst of it right now. And my wife, in her brilliance, and then it made me think about everyone who had emailed me or talked to me about this, she said, why don't you give the lectures or use your class lectures to do the podcast? Explain to people what existential psychotherapy is. Brilliant, brilliant idea. So that's what we're going to do here. It's going to be a several part series. So I'm going to try to keep them all rather self-contained. So if you happen to listen to one or the other, you're not going to miss a whole lot from not taking them in order. So what we're going to do here, we'll see how many it is. Maybe it's four, maybe it's five. Heck, it might even be six of these in a row. Not sure just yet. But there are the classes as I am giving them. Now, they're not going to be live from the residents. I want this to be of good quality, but it's going to be essentially what I'm talking about every week. And I hope after this series is done, you get at least a good sense of how my understanding of human behavior comes from, what existential psychotherapy is, how it explains why we behave both in adaptive ways, healthy ways, and maladaptive ways, ways that make us feel depressed or anxious, or maybe we hurt from physical symptoms. So that's where I'm going to take it here over the next few weeks. Because of the length of these podcasts, I'm going to move away from the traditional format with regards to news and headlines and the like. I'm still going to be posting stories up on thehealthymind.com, so please don't hesitate to go over there for the news. But I'm going to get through this series, and then we'll get back to the regular podcast. So without further ado, here's the first installment of existential psychotherapy. Okay. Well, in today's session, what I want to talk about first off is a general understanding of existential psychotherapy, what it is, where it came from, and maybe what the general themes of this form of understanding the way we behave contains. Now, in this first section, too, I want to go back to Nasir Ghami, who wrote the essay, the brilliant essay, Letter to a Young Psychiatrist. If you are new to the podcast, please take the time. It is so worth going back and listening to my interview of Dr. Ghami. It was a few months back now. It's episode 84, entitled Fixing Psychiatry for Good. If you haven't listened to it, it's worth your time. And in this first session, what I try to emphasize to the residents in psychiatry is really to focus in on what Dr. Ghami is talking about. Because before we even talk about therapy, it's important to understand the humility and the compassion that we have for those that we are privileged to treat, the trust that people give us, even though they may not even know us. And in this, we have to be willing to understand how much we know, but also how much we don't know. Now, Dr. Ghami had written this essay called Letter to a Young Psychiatrist. And if you go to thehealthymind.com and just type in Letter to a Young Psychiatrist, he was kind enough to give me permission to reprint it. And really, it should be read by everyone. Let me also say, based on an email that I got, nurse practitioners, as well as psychiatrists, medical students, and other therapists. But in it, he talks about teaching ignorance, teaching the fact that we don't know. And what is it that we don't know as psychiatrists? Well, there's a lot going on, and not that we are completely ignorant here in understanding what the truth is in how we behave and why we behave, but that we have to be willing to understand that a generation before, people thought they had it all figured out, whether it's medicine or psychiatry or whatever it may be, the sciences. And now we look back a generation later, 50, 60 years later, at some of those theories and just smile. It's important to recognize that there is a certain humility that we have to hold for the potential of what may come out in the future that may make some of these things that we're looking at not really as valid or as on the mark as we thought. So while we lean a lot on medical therapies, biological therapies, antidepressants, and all of the medications, they're important, don't get me wrong. We can't dismiss the fact that biological changes happen in our brains, in our bodies, that can lead to depression or anxiety. Certainly things like bipolar and schizophrenia suggest biology. So I really have a problem when people take the very dogmatic portion on either end of this spectrum. One, those who do not believe there's any biological component to psychiatry. There's nothing that's medical about it. I think that's as off the mark as someone who feels that the only way you can explain all of human behavior is simply by biology, that our understanding of it is so clean right now in psychiatry that there is absolutely no question. And I think somewhere in the middle lies the truth. And because of this, because somewhere in the middle lies the truth, it's so important for us to remember our roots in psychiatry, which was actually talking to people. Yeah. Unfortunately today, not many psychiatrists know what that is about. I see that a lot when people come in to see me. As I've told you before, in our practice, the way that we've run it is that all doctors, all nurse practitioners, see two people an hour. That's it, 30-minute visits. And I'm not getting on some high horse saying this is the only way to do psychiatry. But we always have to remember, no matter how much or little we're seeing our patients, that we talk to people. We can't rely only on the medication, because as Dr. Ghami talks in his essay, we're not Volkswagen mechanics. We don't just say a little bit of this medication, a little bit of this, and then you're fine. It's not how it goes. And also, if we are trained in some way of psychotherapy or understanding why people behave, the humility that we have, that what we think is healing people, you know, these incredible interpretations and theories that I have that say this is why you're upset, and then the person is going to have this epiphany because the great doctor, me, has figured it all out. Well, that's very romantic and beautiful in my mind, but in the real world, it's not how it happens at all. And there's a beautiful, beautiful book by Dr. Irvin Yalom, one of my main influences, at least in my career, called Every Day Gets a Little Closer, A Twice Told Therapy. And what Dr. Yalom, who I'll talk about a little bit more here in a few minutes, an existential psychiatrist, existential psychotherapist, he had taken a journey with a patient who couldn't afford to see him. So all he asked for was that she would just take some notes after each session and write down what she felt was the most important part of the session. And he did the same. And after a while, several months, year or two, they would then take a look at it all. He was hoping that he might have some good material there for a book. And if you've got a chance to read this book, it is so beautiful because it really shows the points that he was making in his notes saying, this is where I think I helped her, was absolutely different than what she was writing down. Now, there were some times when it kind of got in sync, but for the most part, what we think as therapists, as professionals, is making the difference may not be doing that at all. At all. As he writes in his book, Existential Psychotherapy, oftentimes the healing comes in the journey that people take together. The fact that two people are sitting down and both are committed, both are caring, and especially from the professionals, and that the individual who comes in for treatment believes that the person cares, but not believes in a way that you're trying to put over someone, that you really care as a therapist, as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, that you really care. People can pick up on it. If you're patronizing or if you're sugary or syrupy, but the healing comes in the journey, what he called the throw-ins, things that he might talk about his own personal failures or something that's happened in his life, things that connect people to the human side of the person across the chair from you, your therapist or your doctor. So not that that is going to explain every healing moment, but just as that wouldn't explain it all, there's no way that medications and biology explain it all as well. That we've got it figured out so well that every answer has been answered. I think what we've noticed, especially when I had done an interview of one of my influences, Dr. Vlad Maletic here, The Biology of Depression, an earlier podcast here on The Healthy Mind, I asked him, what do you think has been the most important thing that you have found in your years, your career of neuroscientific research? And he said quite clearly, the most important thing he found was more recently that depression is an umbrella diagnosis. A whole lot of things. And really, there can be many reasons for depression. So where we thought we had it figured out, in fact, there's a lot more that we have to learn, and it can't be explained in just one way. It's a beautiful interview. If you're in the mood to listen to some of these older podcasts, if you haven't already, it's episode 66, my interview with Dr. Maletic entitled The Biology of Depression. So those two interviews really can give you a good sense of where we are and maybe where we need to be going in psychiatry. But I want to focus now on existential psychotherapy. What is that? When you're saying existential psychotherapy, what are you talking about? And a lot of, at least my influence, has come from the work of Dr. Irvin Yalom, a therapist who's out of California at Stanford. He's written many, many books, some of them novels that have been very, very successful. He's had a very successful career as an author. But the book that really has influenced me, really changed my life, not only professionally, but also personally, is his book entitled Existential Psychotherapy. And in this, he talked about the basic framework of existential therapy and where these issues of existence cause all of our emotions, create all of our emotions, both the good ones as well as some of the more difficult ones, depression, anxiety, and other disorders. And he talked about how this grew out of the 50s and 60s when psychoanalysis in America was growing, actually dominating. And that was part of the issue that we've wrestled with in terms of our legacy as psychiatrists. We allowed one branch of therapy to dominate. And it's not so much that that branch, there's anything wrong with psychoanalysis or Freudian therapy per se, but the fact that that took over as the dominant when many, if you look at that time period, were also creating great works of knowledge that were a bit different from traditional Freudian analysis. And in studying it further, you'll see that how it took off in America back at that time wasn't necessarily what Freud had hoped would happen with his theories. He hoped that it might be a little bit more open. And unfortunately or fortunately, depending how you look at it, it grew in the way that it did in America. And part of that has allowed for brilliant understandings of the human mind, why we behave the way that we do. But there's also the negative and some of the frustrating aspects of psychoanalysis that also is part of our legacy. So we have to sit and look at all of this. But getting back to that, let me get off my soapbox here. But getting back to existential psychotherapy, the existential therapists at that point, mostly in Europe, we're feeling that, and we're recognizing that there were other ways of understanding these basic conflicts in our lives that can bubble up when the right or wrong times happen, and we can feel it as anxiety or depression or despair. And for a period of time, there was some people maybe in Austria, others in Germany, other parts of Europe, and there wasn't really a cohesive type of understanding of what existential therapy is. And before I go any further, let me just say that my understanding of existential therapy comes principally from the teachings of Dr. Irvin Yalom as a foundation. This is the way that I understand it. There are many individuals who will take a broader view, like Dr. Ghami, who looks at the work of Jaspers and other existential therapists, philosophers, in formulating his theory. So by no means is this the theory only of existential therapy, but at least in the one that allowed me to form my understanding of human behavior and how I've tried to help people, this is the one that I'm going to present for you. But as this grew, there was one individual in particular, Dr. Rollo May, who put this together in a phenomenal book called Existence, really taking all of these individual people that were around the world and really introduced the idea of existential therapy to America, to the United States. And in that, then, we began to see a following of and a development of those who practice existential psychotherapy. Now, it's important to say there was no way that that was going to, as a field, grow existential therapy to the degree that Freudian analysis did. And if you really look at the basic structure of existential therapy, a lot of it comes, you can see the influences of Freudian therapy. But in this, the basic understanding or the basic structure of our behavior and what we try to deal with when we're talking about these issues of existence, or what Yalom called the ultimate concerns, the ultimate concerns of existence. And these are, number one, death; number two, isolation; number three, freedom; and number four, meaning. So death, isolation, meaning, and freedom. And what does that mean, Peter? What are you talking about? Well, what Yalom understood and came to present as his theory was that all of us suffer from these, don't suffer, we have these conditions. All of us face these anxieties. They're part of the human condition. And here is where at least the first departure is in traditional Freudian analysis, which I try to understand as kind of a top-down. You've got the therapist who's kind of removed, and the individual who comes in to see them, the patient, does most of the talking. There's interpretation by the therapist, but classically, the therapist wouldn't even face the patient. They'd lie on the couch so that the therapist, the room, was a blank slate, and the person would paint their emotional life onto it, so to speak. In existential therapy, it is much different. There's more of a one-to-one. It's an equal relationship between the therapist, the psychiatrist, and the individual patient who's coming in. And the reason this is because, as I said, these issues of existence, these ultimate concerns, are part of the human condition. I struggle with them. You struggle with them. And those who may suffer from emotional problems suffer with them as well. So there has to be that relationship there because we're talking about the same thing. Now, what are we talking about when we say, well, the ultimate concerns are death, freedom, isolation, and meaning? What does that mean? According to Yalom, what we struggle with are conflicts at all of these ultimate concerns. We face in our lives these moments where we're pushed up against almost like what I oftentimes will tell to my patients, these tectonic plates. Picture two earthquake plates coming together, right? Like in California, where you have the San Andreas Fault. Well, that's one piece of earth going east and another one going west. And where they meet, there's incredible pressure. And from time to time, when that lets go, boom, there's an earthquake. Ton of energy that's released. Well, when we look at these conflicts, it's helpful sometimes to think about that as those earthquake plates. And what do I mean? When we're talking about, let's say, the first ultimate concern, probably the most influential of all of them, the one that dominates, at least in what I see in my patients, is this concern of death, mortality. But how does that relate to earthquake plates and tectonic plates? According to Yalom, the existential concern, the ultimate concern of death, is always this battle between, I don't want to die, I want to live, and the realization that my life is finite. I'm not going to live forever. So you see how these two push. On one end, you're saying, I want to live, I'm going to live. And on the other end, in the back of our minds, I'm sure you felt it from time to time, there's going to be a period of time where we're not here. All of us, everyone who has existed, faces that. Now, it isn't the happiest thing to talk about, but in that, what Yalom tried to do was we don't have to sanitize this. It's an ultimate concern. But we face this constantly. And as I have talked about before, as I've written in a chapter that I contributed to a book called The Psychology of Meaning, I talked about what I call the existential onion, if you will. And in this, you picture these layers of the onion skin that are on top of each other. And as we face these struggles, these anxieties, crisis moments, trauma, loss, where we begin to feel anxious or depressed or sad, what happens is the onion layers, the onion skin layers, represent our defenses, the way that we deal with these problems. And if we get a little too close to the core, a little too close to where we're thinking about, well, my gosh, what's this all about? How long am I here? I don't want to think about the fact that my life has limited time, even though it may be decades from now. I still am not going to be here forever. It's an uncomfortable place to be. And when that really comes to the surface, people can start to feel anxious or depressed. We see it a lot of times. People come in when they're not feeling well or depressed, and they say, what's life all about? What am I doing with my life? Is this what it's going to be until I die? This is what's going to happen? Or if it gets a bit more severe, why do I even need to be around? So we see this theme of death that is there. And in the next discussion, the next podcast episode, I'm going to take each of these apart. Death, meaning, isolation, and freedom. But from our purposes here today in the introductory lecture or podcast, I'm just going to talk about generalities. So death is one of them. The next is existential isolation. Now, what does this mean? Existential aloneness. The fact that no matter how close we are to people, there is that unbridgeable gap where we are facing the world alone. Now, what does this mean, facing alone? I'm with folks. I've married. I've got a partner. I've got kids. What does this mean that I'm alone? What are you talking about, Zafiridis? Well, go ahead and kick your foot against the wall. Just kick the wall real quick. Not too hard, okay, but you know what I mean. Or slap yourself, you know, on the thigh or something like that as hard as you can. That hurts. It hurts, doesn't it? It's painful. And no matter how much you try and describe that, even to your spouse or your partner or your loved ones, your family members, no one can feel that pain other than you. No one. And that is that unbridgeable gap. People can be in our lives, and we find great solace in that and meaning and fulfillment. But it is this push and pull between, I don't want to be alone in this world. But sometimes, despite everyone that I'm around and those who love me, I feel alone. Again, picture those tectonic plates, those earthquake plates, those earth pieces of earth pushing against each other. One end is saying, well, I'm here with people. I'm not alone. And the other part is, wait a minute. Even though you're with people, you feel isolated, and that can be scary. Now, when people feel anxious or depressed, these issues come up. How often have I heard, I feel so alone? No one understands what I'm going through. I feel totally by myself in a bubble where the whole world is going on with its business, but I am right here. That onion is peeling. An existential onion. And those feelings of isolation are there. Now, don't get me wrong. Whether it is death or anxiety or freedom or meaning, we use those anxieties of the human condition to create such beautiful things. They can motivate us in very, very healthy ways as well to create, to find meaning, to marry or to be with someone, to have children. They don't all have to be bad, but what I want people to understand is this kind of push and pull. It's that fault line right there where the pressure is. Between the two pieces of earth, one moving east, one moving west, that causes some of the problems like depression and anxiety. So existential isolation and death, let's talk about the idea of freedom. Freedom. Now, why would freedom scare us? What is so bad about freedom? We're a democratic republic. This country was built on freedom. Zafiridis, why is freedom so bad? What are you going to tell me now, radio boy? Well, here, when we're talking about existential freedom, we're talking about the push and pull, kind of right there at the fault line, the two forces that are there on one end. Don't tell me what to do. I have the freedom to do anything I want, which is true. But if that is the case, then you're responsible completely for figuring it all out. You. And on the surface or first glance, that might sound okay, but you got 1,000 channels on your cable box, your TV. How many do you really watch? If you're like me, 6, 7 maybe, right? Maybe 10, Maybe you're a big TV watcher. Okay, 20. How many do you really watch, though? But that feeling at times where you're like, oh, what am I going to watch? And you've got 1,000 channels and you don't know what to pick. Well, there's the balance. Tell me what to watch. Don't tell me too much in terms of that, but give me some structure so I know what to do. Don't give me too much structure because I don't want to feel like I have no control. But this is this issue of existential freedom, the balance between the fact that we want freedom, we crave it, but also if we have total freedom, it's groundless below us. We have to put the ground in. So how do we have enough structure in our lives, but not too much where we feel that we have lost all control? And we see that so often, these issues of freedom, whether it is manifesting itself as boredom, I don't know what to do, or people coming in and anxious, not knowing what to do, facing these points in their lives where there are many, many options. Or on the other end, people feel like they're so locked in their lives, whether it is a bad job, a bad relationship, a bad marriage, and feeling that they can't make a change. And not on a pathological way in terms of if you had to come in and see a psychiatrist, but I ask you, think about what you're doing. Think about what you're doing, whether it's a relationship or your career. And maybe at times where you've thought, man, I'd like to do something else. Wow, I should have been a writer. I should have gone and done something in art. I don't know, whatever it may be for you, but you haven't done it. And how many times have you said to yourself, well, I just can't do it. That's not really realistic. I can't go and change things. I mean, come on. I mean, how am I going to do that? Well, you just do it. You make a plan and decide that's what you really want, and you move towards it. I mean, you can save a lot of money on self-help books and basically understand that what every self-help book is trying to tell you is that our mind is what prevents us from doing most of the things that we are capable of doing and want to do. Our mind in the form of fear and self-doubt. Now, don't get me wrong. It's going to be pretty hard for me at age 47 to now become an astronaut, if that's what I wanted to do. But in terms of moving towards anything that you may want or feel like you need to change, you can change it. You absolutely can. If you've been listening to this podcast over the last couple of years, you know that that is my principal focus here, is for you to understand that you are so powerful. You can make these changes. Only our fear and doubt gets in our way. And one of the biggest anxieties there, the biggest concerns that limit us, is this existential concept of freedom. We want to know that we can do these things, but if I know that I can change tomorrow and go move towards something I want to do, then it's all up to me. I've got to create the structure, and that can be very uncomfortable for people. So you stay safe. You stay safe. Doesn't mean you're always going to be happy, but the thought of going and doing that might cause more anxiety. But you absolutely have the ability to do these things. I always tell people, you know, we feel like we're so closed in our lives that we don't have the ability to change from one thing to something else, whether it's a career or relationship. We think these walls are concrete, that we're locked in this box and we can't move them. But, you know, you press on the walls and it's an illusion. It's paper. The walls aren't concrete. Only our fear and doubt make us feel like it's concrete. They're paper. You can push right on them and begin to move to a different plan in your life. This existential concept of freedom, the push and pull between wanting to be free, but also what that means and the fear of not having structure and staying safe, pushing on those two things at once. I want freedom, but I kind of like structure. I want freedom, I kind of like structure. And then finally, the last of the four concerns, meaning. Meaning, what is the purpose? Really, what's the purpose of anything in this world? the way we understand the world is very unique to us. You may understand it in a more spiritual or religious way in terms of why all of this is, or a more secular or scientific way. But in essence, all of us basically want to get a sense of why we're here. What is this all about? And more specifically, what is my purpose here on this rock known as the Earth? What am I doing here? Why am I even here? And the great push there, where that conflict is, those two plates coming together, is on one end pushing west is, yeah, here's how I understand life to be, what I'm doing here, why I came here, why we're all here, and what I'm going to do. And the other plate is pushing the other way, just saying, maybe there is no meaning. Maybe there is no meaning other than that which we create. I've got it figured out. I know what's going on. Don't claim that you do, because maybe there is no meaning to any of this. And when I say that, I'm not trying to offend or alienate anyone who has their convictions, whether they're religious or spiritual or secular, whatever it may be. That's not what I'm trying to do here, is push. Who am I to say what you believe is either right or wrong? But that's not the point. The conflict, when we start to understand that, is the push between wanting, craving meaning, and understanding everything about what we're doing and why we're here and what this is all about, pushing against the other plate, which is saying, maybe there is no meaning. Maybe there is no meaning. We are just here. And when you think about that, just considering that for a second, for many people, can be very uncomfortable. What do you mean that we're just here? And that can be really hard. And we certainly see that come up in the clinical setting with individuals when they're depressed or anxious, saying, I don't know what this is all about. When I get depressed, when I get anxious, I don't know what my purpose in life is. I don't even know what I'm doing. What are we even worrying about, some of these things? I don't know what it's all about. And we can see how subject to change our understanding or meaning can be if we've been through a trauma, or you've been through a difficult time in your life, or a loss, some adversity that you've gotten through. Maybe it's a health issue or some kind of loss of a loved one or a close family member. Sometimes getting that close and so traumatized can have a profound change in meaning and understanding of the world. So we can see how that can bend and warp and change, both in positive ways, but also in negative ways, this concept of meaning. And in understanding what existential therapy is talking about, is all of behavior is thought to be able to emanate or be created, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, based on the tug and pull of these main four ultimate concerns or forces. The concept of mortality or death, the concept of existential isolation or aloneness, the concept of existential freedom versus structure, and the concept of meaning versus the fact that there may be no meaning or meaninglessness. And in that, Yalom goes on to describe both the basis for the understanding and ways as professionals we can intervene to help a person through this time. But the important part, if I can go back to Dr. Ghami's letter to a young psychiatrist, and I'm sorry for jumping around, but I guess it's kind of how my mind works, but going back to Dr. Ghami, we have to have the humility to realize that just because we think we understand human behavior, and I'm talking about me as a psychiatrist, as I am helping my patients through this, I should never be pompous or arrogant enough to believe or to assume that just because I make an interpretation or offer something that I feel would be helpful clinically, that that is the reason why people feel better and get better when they see me. Dr. Yalom, in his book, A Twice Told Therapy, has rather resoundingly shown how what he thinks is helping and what the patient feels are two very different things. And while as a profession, we can get all defensive and feel upset that there's so much uncertainty, whether it's in the biological or in the psychological, I think we've got to grow up and accept the humility. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with uncertainty. In the end of the day, we're still helping people. At least I hope that most of you are, if you're listening to this and you are a professional, a clinician, or a therapist. We're helping people. And just because it may vary from the way that we think the healing is coming, doesn't really matter. A person feels better. A life is made easier. Maybe a person can breathe a little better, can face the day. Now, whether that was because you talked about some existential concern or a cognitive behavioral concern, doesn't matter. A person is better. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have any kind of structure and understand where behavior is coming from and follow guidelines and therapeutic approaches, whether it's in therapy or medicine. But we don't forget about the person who we are treating as a human being, first and foremost. And that we are not just the therapist or the psychiatrist or the doctor, the nurse practitioner, but we as well are human beings. And some, if not most, dare I say, if not all of the healing that comes is in that relationship, in that caring and that compassion and that trust that is there between two individuals. I always tell the residents, I tell the medical students, you have to realize the privilege that you are given because that trust is given to you without you even being known to the person who comes in to see you. It's given to you because of who you are. Don't mess it up. Remember to relate on a human level. Provide your expertise, but relate on a human level. See the person as John Smith, not your 3:30 appointment. See them as John Smith, not my next medication management visit. See them as John Smith, not my newest evaluation. You'll notice how much better people get and how much more fulfilled you will be in your career. We'll talk more about existential psychotherapy on the next podcast. And rather than describe what it is, depending on whether or not you're listening to this in order, I'll just introduce each topic during each episode. That way, if other than this introductory episode, you're going to be able to interchange them and move them around, and each one is its own kind of contained unit that you can listen to without feeling like you missed something before. I hope you enjoy this. A little bit different here from anything that I've done before on the Healthy Mind podcast, but as I said, the opportunity presented itself with the residents and my class, and also over the last couple of years, people asking a little bit more about existential psychotherapy. So let me know if you like it. Let me know if I need to do something different, if you feel it's too long, if it should be shorter. Let me know, because I want this to be the best it can be for you. And I really appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to end this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. Thank you for your patience and your understanding that it's been a bit of a break for me. Believe me, I love doing these podcasts. It was as painful for me not to do them, but time and just everything that I had to do didn't allow me to do that. I am going to make it a priority from here on out. I never want to wait 3 weeks or so to do another podcast. I just love doing it too much. The website, as always, thehealthymind.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis. You can listen to all of these podcasts right on thehealthymind.com or go to iTunes. You can really help support the show for free, really, if you can do a review for me at iTunes, or maybe let your friends and family know, maybe post it on Facebook or Twitter, wherever you do. Gosh, that would be wonderful. I really do appreciate it. Any questions or comments, do not hesitate to contact me. Email is peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.